Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we get to sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and related music industry experts. If you love playing guitar, stick around, you're in the right place. Hey everybody, this is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar. And a lot of people ask or say to me, you know, I have a marketing business and people tell me, they say, Craig, you're very good in marketing. And I don't really think I am. I think what I'm good is understanding people. And I say that because the guest I have on the show today, it's very easy to understand this guy. He's a genuinely, you don't need to be a psychologist to see the good qualities in this person. He's warm, kind, bright, extremely nice, introspective, and most important, he's genuine. And I'm real privileged to have Jeff King with us today. Jeff's a studio musician and touring musician out of Nashville. He's one of the power A-listers. He's turning red. but it's true. He's one of the top Nashville guys. He's established himself as one of the prominent musicians in both studio and touring. I'm going to talk about some of the albums he's played on, but literally this is, you know, scratching the surface in a very, very, very broad sense. He's played on records by Faith Hill, Josh Turner, Pam Tillis, Randy Travis, Reba McEntire, Art Garfunkel, Johnny Cash, Dave Matthews, Joe DiMassina, Blackhawk, Craig Morgan, Phil Vassar, Tony Braxton, Trace Adkins, Joe Nichols, Lee Bryce, and loads of others. And if you want more, go to allmusic.com and just enter Jeff King and you'll see it. He's also toured with Patti Loveless, Leroy Parnell, Leanne Womack, Tim McGraw, Reba McEntire and Kelly Clarkson, and Reba and Brooks and Dunn. He's also performed on many national television shows with artists, as well as being in the house band. And these programs include Good Morning America, The Tonight Show, Jay Leno, Late Night with David Letterman, Conan, Jimmy Fallon, Regis and Kelly, Craig Ferguson, The View, Oprah, the CMAs, the ACMs, the ACM Honors Awards, Live at the Ryman, Grand Ole Opry Live, Monday Night Concerts with Ricky Skaggs, and Nashville Now. I'm like exhausted. I feel like the interview's over, not starting. Just reading your stuff, man. Thank you so much, Jeff, so much for coming on the show, man. I can't thank you enough.
Glad to be here, Craig. Thanks for asking.
Oh, yeah, man. So I want to go down maybe consecutively. I mean, we'd need a month to go through this, but let's go down maybe consecutively and talk about how I, you know, sort of presented things in the bio. You've played with so many iconic artists, and what my question is, what did you take away from some of these guys? Like, what were the lessons, the important lessons you learned, either with respect to playing on your own, your playing with others, business, or life? And so I'll throw a few names out there if you could give me some feedback on these. Randy Travis.
Well, let's see. I could give you a little bit of the background on.
Yeah, please.
On how I met Randy. When I was touring with Patti Loveless in the 80s, late 80s, we opened a lot of shows for Randy Travis. So I was around him and his great band at the time. And when I left Patti in 91 and started doing sessions, I found myself actually doing a Randy Travis. Actually, it wasn't a whole record. It was, I think we were doing a Joe DiMassina record. And the producer asked, hey, is everybody okay to stay for another hour or two? And we said, sure, yeah. So he said, well, I've got a couple songs I need to get done for my Randy Travis record I'm working on. So that's how I ended up on a Randy Travis record, which was, you know, actually Randy wasn't there at the time, but I'd spent a lot of time with him on the tours we did. And then the USO tours, we covered Japan and Korea, and I did Alaska with him for a week, which was in December. So experienced 60 weather.
Holy! How do you play? I mean, literally, how can you play with your hands bitter cold?
Well, you know, luckily we were inside, so it's still so cold up there. But it was an awesome experience.
Yeah.
I mean, but Randy was always great, and you know his. His music was always pretty straight up country, and you know, everything was about the song. So much of the stuff is, you know, things change and they, you know, as they develop into more programmy things and, you know, you just kind of learn how to navigate. As far as guitar, you learn how to navigate those worlds and what your role is in that particular situation. So,
What did you learn most from working with Randy in that experience?
I think you, just embrace the, you know, he was so country. I learned just to not try to reinvent the wheel. I don't know if that makes sense, but you know,
no, it does. Stick to the formula. We just that's a good format. Yeah. That's cool. How about Reba? I know you worked with her a lot.
I have, and there's a world of information with Reba and her organization. You know, the most important thing about as a musician in that bunch is to be is to always be prepared as much as possible. For instance, when we go in for rehearsals, we want to go in and kind of know what we're doing and be prepared for the changes that will come. And then she'll come in the last couple days of a rehearsal for a tour or whatever. And when she comes in, she is definitely prepared and ready to go. And they like to come in and rehearse and get it done and enjoy the shows. So when I was hired for that, they asked me, you know, if I would be interested in coming out and doing some shows on the road, and I hadn't done the road for a while. That was probably 2006.
Oh, wow. And
yeah, I've been there for touring with her for 11 years now. And, you know, some years may have done 60 dates a year on some of the bigger tours. And a lot of that has been 25, 30, 35 dates. So it's not been really crazy. It's been a great gig. It allows me to keep my session world intact and not be gone all the time, but be out with her. And, you know, back to your question, I don't know. I think you develop a thing out there where you learn about structure. Everybody has a job and you just show up and do your job and, you know, be helpful to everybody. But everybody kind of has that mentality. So they, you know, the crew is great. The, you know, all the production guys are great and you don't have to worry about stuff. I mean, I bring a couple boxes of strings out, and if I forget, you know, which I don't normally, but the tech always has. It's like, well, I'll run by and pick up a box, and we'll be good. And so you're surrounded with a team of people that are like-minded, and everybody does their job. So that's a really important part of that wheel because of the way it travels on the road and. It's a great situation to be in.
Yeah, I would imagine. I'm sitting here. I would imagine all the dressings, or you know, the bus, the tour, the hotels you're staying in. That's not the first job you get when you come to Nashville. That's something that you work up to, you know. And then to stay in there, and then to have, as you said, the most times you're out is 30, 35 days. That's fantastic.
Right. Yeah.
You know, to be living that well. And I don't mean that in any way other than, you know, a gratefulness way to be right. Treated that well and only have to be out for 35 days, man. That's it is a great situation. That's fantastic. Funny story. You know, do you know Dave Fowler, bass player?
Oh yeah. I know Dave well. Yeah.
And I asked him this question. He's toured with Dolly.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what's the most important thing? And he said three words, man. He goes, be on time.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
It was funny, man. He said,
that's exactly right.
Yeah, he said, if you're 10 minutes early, you're late. He said, you kind of.
That's the same with Reba. They're, you know, always early. Never, you don't want to be the guy that's there while they're waiting for you.
Yeah. Well, they have so many people, they have to be disciplined. You can't run a show that size, I'm assuming, with, you know, people kind of casually.
Right.
You have to do everything deliberately with intent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What about Art Garfunkel? What'd you do with Art? That was interesting.
I did a record. It was it was sort of a trio record. And unfortunately, I can't remember the Mia Sharp was one of the artists, and I can't think of the other one right now. But it was a guy, and it was really fun. It was really interesting to hear that voice coming through.
Yeah. Because you heard, it's so iconic. It's so, I mean, those guys had literally maybe 50 to 60 hits.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was a total iconic thing. And Ark was just, again, you know, most of the things that, the big things that I learned are commit to the music and kind of, you know, trendy things are great, you know, whatever, but the core of everything is what's important to those folks, you know.
Did he come down to Nashville or did you go up to New York for that?
He came down to Nashville, and an interesting side note, he and his producer, at the guy that was producing that project, his name is Billy Mann, New York producer, and they were both in Nashville, and we were at a studio called Omni. And I can't remember if it was the first day or the second day, but one of those days was 9/11.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was a powerful, it was a very powerful day. But things happened that I will never forget beyond what happened.
Yeah.
It was a very emotional day in our studio because they were both from New York. And so I remember getting to the studio and the TV was on. And it had already happened, or, you know, the main first part of it had already happened. And we were sitting there, all of us gathered around the TV, just stunned, you know, numb. And Billy says, he reaches over to the screen. He says, "That's my building. That's my apartment building right over there." And then he gets a phone call, and it's his wife walking down the street. And she says, I can't go back to our house because they've got it blocked off, because some of the debris is over in there. And she said, I went jogging with no money. All I've got is my phone. And she, you know, he directed her. But, you know, that story kind of goes on. And Art was, you know, very quiet. And we watched. And as a band and engineering staff, I mean, we were like, well, what do we do? I mean, do we go home? What do we stay here? And so Billy got us all together in the main cutting room. And he said, you know, if we go home, they win. And I was like, well, yeah, I get that. And he says, everybody okay with working, you know, that will, you know, maybe something good will come out of the day. And we were like, well, sure. You know, and then, he asked if it was okay to lead in a prayer. Boy, it was an intense thing because, you know, it was just something that was a very memorable, heartfelt moment in my career. So yeah. I'll never forget that, but the days, you know, the day went on and we focused on what we were doing and we had as good a day as possible due to the circumstances. And it turned out a pretty awesome project. I was really proud to be a part of that one.
That's great. Yeah, that's so out of context because there's no frame of reference to know how to react in that.
Right.
It's a very awkward thing. Yeah, so he must have lived or closer to downtown, which is where the attacks happened. Because I know Art, I think, oddly enough, an old client of mine years ago was good friends with Art. And Art lives like on Central Park East, I think, he was telling me, further uptown.
Right, yeah.
So
I remember them saying that. Billy lives up, it's down near, you know, where everything is.
Battery Park, near Battery Park, probably.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, how about this one? I mean, I don't even know how to, I can't imagine what this experience is like. Johnny Cash.
Well, and this, there's always a story.
Yeah, man, I love the stories.
Well, I was working on a record. A friend of mine was producer on a record for a soundtrack for the movie We Were Soldiers. And he called me and he said, "Hey, I've got some songs we need, you know, we need to do. I'd love to get you over here. And so most of my part on that was overdubs. So I go in and he says, we've got this Johnny Cash song that they actually cut with Johnny's band down in the Caribbean at his studio. And we're going to redo this song and kind of bring it more current and put it on this record because it's a great song. And I said, okay. So what they did was they took the song and they stretched it out and put it on a grid and put a couple cool loops in there. It was a very vibey song.
I don't mean to interrupt you. When you say they stretched it out and put it on a grid, what do you mean by that?
Well, like in Pro Tools, it was an old song, like I said, so they probably didn't cut it with a click. Mm-hmm. And the track was really great. It was just they wanted a modern version of it.
Okay.
And this is the song that they put Dave Matthews on later on. That's kind of how I ended up on this song. But to say I worked with those guys is probably a stretch, honestly. But you know, to be on a project with those guys was definitely very cool because Johnny, unfortunately, was already gone from died before. And so to me, one of the interesting things about that is they stripped the song down. And, you know, like I said, they made it all work where it was in time with the Pro Tools grid. And so all the loop beats, you know, everything would feel right.
Right.
So they were meticulous about that. And then they said, well, this starts with an acoustic guitar and it's we need to replace that to work with our situation. And I said, okay. So I went in, I got an acoustic and went in and, you know, we had to put a count off on. And then all of a sudden there's the click in, you know, maybe a kick drum or something. And I start just playing this strum, you know, the thing. And all of a sudden there's Johnny's big voice and I'm just playing acoustic guitar. And I'm going,
was that weird?
It was chilling is what it was. I hadn't stopped at first. I went, wow, this is an interesting moment for me. And my friend Chris Farron, that was the producer, he goes, yeah, this is, you know, playing with Johnny Cash. And after he's died, it's a pretty interesting, you know, thing, you know. But we overdubbed on the track and I can't remember the name of the song, but it's a really cool song. And we put some electrics on and at the end, it's this huge, big thing. And, that was a cool day for me. So, because Johnny Cash, I remember, watching his show as a kid and, you know, being inspired by, I can't think of the guitar player's name right now, but, you know, he always had the
He was just a larger than life character. Johnny was so just larger than life. That's the only way you could say it.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on, because I've talked to a lot of session guys our age, and I often hear, nostalgia for the times where you had an actual band playing in the studio as opposed to the way things are done today. Yet, at the same time, had technology not be the way it is, there'd be so many opportunities just like that one you just talked about that would not exist. So how do you find what are your thoughts on that? Or is there a happy medium or you just kind of go with the flow? What are your thoughts, I guess, on that?
Do you mean between the old and the new sort of?
Yeah, where you'd sit in a room with and actually play with a bunch of musicians to do something versus, you know, come in a room or in your home studio downstairs and do something. And then you're putting a song together, you know, on the one hand, there's the nostalgia for men that I'm sure there's nothing like sitting in a room of musicians playing together, especially when you all click, it's gotta be like making magic.
Right.
At the same time, now you're doing it this way sometimes. And these opportunities wouldn't exist if it wasn't for this technology. So it's,
well, that's the truth, really. I was lucky enough to be there, when that's all it was tracking in a room full of guys on a tape machine. And I was lucky enough to hit a few years where there was it was mostly no click and the drummer, you know, you learned to play in time. And, you know, I practiced with a metronome for a long, long time. I mean, that was just part of my deal. And so you learn how to feel the subdivisions even when you're not counting them.
Yeah, yeah.
And to be in a room with guys, you know, ideas are bouncing around and you're hearing things. And, you know, like the drummer might hear something the vocal does on the last chorus. And, you know, he might hit a beat two thing on every time he gets to that chorus. And you go, oh, I'm going to do that. And then the steel player, the piano player might play a lick in the chorus. And you go, hey, you know, it might be cool if I play that in unison with you, but maybe lower. So we get sort of a cool, you know, a bigger lick.
Yeah.
Whatever that's carrying. So, and now it's somewhat the same, you know, but you're sort of on your own with it, especially if I'm doing a whole track by myself. You know, sometimes guys will send a drum bass track. Maybe it has keys on it and vocals, and I'm doing acoustic guitars and electric guitars. So I sort of, you know, work my way through the song and find out the things to do. But each thing has its value. I think the spontaneous stuff happens with when there are, you know, four or five guys in the room, and when you're home, you're your own spontaneous thing.
Well, so, yeah, it's got to be tougher in a way when you're on your own because there's no sort of idea prompts.
Right. Lots of times I'm at home by myself, and I sort of wish there were somebody to go, hey, let's go this direction or this direction, because I sort of just take off and go the way that I feel the song is drawing me. So, and luckily I think I've had good luck with most people liking that. Yeah. Occasionally somebody will go, hey, can you give me another solo that's less of something or more of something or whatever. So,
And then you just have to go back and cut it.
And you just go, I open it up and I've got the same, you know, same settings. And I just try to remember what guitar I used and what amp I used, or come up with something totally different. Hmm.
You mentioned Dave Matthews. What was it like working with him?
Well, that was on that song with Johnny Cash. Hmm. And I didn't really know I had worked with Dave Matthews until the record came out.
he's got I saw Santana in concert, like, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago. And one of the things I was amazed at is, you know, he had 12 people on stage. And from and he's been doing this. He's had 12 people on stage since Woodstock, roughly, you know, or pretty close to after that, you know. Right. I was in amazed at how that was a well-oiled machine, and I can't imagine managing, you know, all those moving parts. And Dave Matthews in the same situation. He's got loads of guys up on stage with him. I don't know if it's 12 or how many, but he's got a full house up there sometimes.
Right.
And I'm curious how do you get your arms around that whole thing? Cause they're playing, they're tight.
Yeah. Man. I think everybody kind of develops their part and learns their part. And, bands that big, you really have to listen to what's going on. You can't just jump in and noodle, you know, you have to pay attention to what everybody's doing. Otherwise it just sounds like a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I think it's important to, and it sounds like those guys really do. So that's a good thing.
So selection of players is critical, especially in a larger unit like that, is what I'm hearing.
Absolutely. Yeah. That would be the correct answer, I think.
Of all the tours you've done, which one was the most productive for you as far as honing your chops?
Well, I don't know that there's one, but when I started with Patti Loveless, I had Albert Lee had played on some of her records, and
you had to recreate Albert Lee's parts.
Recreate Albert Lee and learn the bending things, and which I had my Tele has a G bender in it, so it made it a little bit better, because I think that Albert had a B bender. So, you know, there was a little bit of a change there to try to figure out the way some of that stuff worked. But man, to dive right in and learn stuff that was, I really loved anyway. So it was, and Ray Flack from the great Ricky Skaggs era, Highway 40 Blues and all that stuff, had played on a bunch of that record, or her records. So, you know, I was deep in the middle of the Tele territory, and really, it was really great for me to dig in and learn all that stuff. And I think I came out of that knowing a lot more about how to play Tele, finger, you know, chicken picking Tele and the stuff that Albert does. So, and then with a different, you know, in a different respect, I think doing the Reba Kelly Clarkson tour, we were both bands, Kelly's and Reba's band, and with the exception of the poor sad bass players had to set out a song, they had to change. But I was in both bands, and so I learned the extra Kelly parts, which were very modern-y type things, and kind of forced me to listen to things in a new way. Which, after doing that, it really helped me in my session world to open up my eyes to so many different options and get myself out of any of the routines that I had developed and that just came to me naturally. So I think those both tours were really important development-wise for me.
It's funny you said that, because that's where I was curious about how it impacted you when you came back. And the reason what made me ask that question is when I interviewed Jerry McPherson, he said that when he went out with Vince Gill, he had to learn all these Dan Huff lines. And right. He said the exact, almost verbatim, that you did. He goes, but when I, and it was really a challenge. But when I came back to the session, I was a different, when I came back to the session world, it was like, you know, now I have, exactly what you said, now I had all these new arrows in my quiver to pull and to, mm-hmm. to shoot, you know. So I was curious if you had a similar experience, which you obviously did. How many songs were you playing Reba and Kelly in one night? That had to be.
Well, you know what's funny is we rehearsed for probably 2 or 3 weeks, and then we went, so I think we went to North Dakota, wherever the first show was. We went there and rehearsed for a week because there was a lot of production stuff going on. And I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. What was the question?
You were saying you rehearsed for I was saying how many songs you have to play, and you said you rehearsed for 2 to 3 weeks in town and then a week in North Dakota.
Right. Well, I don't know how many songs, but it was a whole lot, because at the end of the first couple shows, I remember walking off stage going, why am I so tired? But then we look back at least a 2-hour show. So yeah. However many songs that would be. I think there were maybe a couple songs that I didn't play on that were more acoustic moments or something. But it was a night of explosive music from both sides, because they would sing on each other's songs. And it was great to see Reba do the more modern stuff. And it was great to, Kelly was a great, Kelly's a great country singer.
Mm. And oh, great voice.
Yeah, just a great singer. Yeah. And the band, her band was awesome. And, you know, there were a bunch of tweakers on MacBooks, so I learned tons of MacBook shortcuts from those guys.
That's great. That's great. So when you're rehearsing in a situation like that, 2 to 3 weeks and then a week in North Dakota, what is a rehearsal like? Is it all day that you're rehearsing? Or how many hours a day would you say you're rehearsing?
Generally 10 to 5, but with the exception of you might come in at 10 and for whatever reason they're building a loom on the keyboards rig or something and they need a little more time. So we sit around and drink coffee for a little while. And then once they get that, we'll go over a couple songs. Then we might kind of look at the structures and maybe adjust our parts. then we might take a break for a few minutes and run them again. And, you know, the thing that I found comforting about those tours were, generally speaking, I knew what every note I was going to play, which allowed me to really enjoy the moments of the show, because I could, I kind of sort of knew what I'm supposed, what my job is. But, and that's what the 3 weeks prior to any of those tours would be. You would really learn, you would, you know, expand your thing and then develop it and then hone it. So I would go out knowing exactly what I was supposed to be doing, which was a lot of fun. It could be boring, but it's all in how you look at it. You know, the crowds were so amazing, and they were having such a great time. It was just great to watch the machine work, you know.
So when you say enjoy the show, you mean ability to music, I guess, participate in your own interaction with the audience?
Absolutely. And the other guys on stage and the artists.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, we had, we didn't have to do any dancing or anything, but there were marks we would hit for solos, and you know, you need to be where you're going to be when it's time to be there, because the spotlight was coming on that spot.
Right.
And if you weren't there. So there were some things to remember like that, but yeah, you definitely spend that rehearsal time kind of, it's an adjustment period to adjusting down to what parts you're going to play and how you get those sounds. And, you know, part of the early rehearsals, we were dialing in sounds on some of the songs, you know, so there would be some time for that. And, you know, you try to maybe dial things in before you get there. But then again, you know, when you hear the band, your part, you know, your sound changes, because it might be too much low end or too much high end, or you might be in somebody else's area, or more delay, less delay, none, whatever. So
all this, that's all the things that get worked out. It's kind of like building a sculpture, I would imagine, that, you know, when you first come in, you got the big block of wood or clay, and you kind of shape it down, and then by the week or the night before, or the whatever, a few days before, now you're dealing with, you know, the volume and the things that you're talking about. How, you know, do you have to adjust here or there to make sure you're not in other people's, you know, that's the eyelashes on the sculpture at the tail end. Interesting. Very interesting. At the end, we'll turn on the video. I want to see your dance. That's a special bonus.
You don't want to see me dance.
me and you both. I had a question here. Which house bands were you in on the television shows you played? But I would assume that was the CMAs and the ACM stuff that was local, or did you actually play in a house band on some of the national TV shows as well?
I did. Well, let's see. I'm going to pull that up because I can't remember. I was on. I was in a couple of the ACM bands. One we did in LA a few years. I mean, this was a long time ago, and I don't remember some of that stuff. It just gets a little foggy after a while. And some of the CMA stuff, I was in the house band. The ACM Honors we just did about 3 weeks ago, I was in the house band on that.
I would imagine that's a fun night for you, because I would imagine it's you and all your contemporaries from Nashville that are there. Yeah. So that's probably a fun kind of thing. Guys you've known for probably years, and you're all together getting to play.
Yeah.
That's nice.
It's a lot of fun, but it can be stressful, because, you know, there's a definite time frame you're working in, and you have a chart book in front of you, and, you know, going back to being prepared as much as possible, but you might get the material 2 weeks ahead of time, and it changes about every 2 days. So you might start with 20 songs and 2 weeks out, and it might be a different, you know, maybe 7 of those songs are the same by the time you get to show night.
Oh,
so,
wow. Why is that? You know,
I think it has to do with maybe sometimes the timing on songs, and some of the artists maybe can't do, you know, something's come up or whatever. I don't really know, but it just changes. Things change. And maybe they're looking at it from the shows. Lots of those shows, they look at it from the show standpoint, and we're looking at it from the band music standpoint, but they're looking at the big, you know.
Yeah, there's all the chefs, too many chefs in the kitchen, or a lot of chefs in the kitchen on something like that, I would imagine. Yeah, I'm sure. Of the national TV shows you did, do any of them stand out for anything, either the good time you had, or did, you know, certain people, you know, maybe give you guys more creative freedom, or just more fun, or they really ran things well?
I think all of those shows were ran very well. They were very tight because of the schedules were so tight on those guys. And, you know, doing David Letterman was huge for me because I'd been watching that show forever. And
that was on my mind. I'm glad you talked to us. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Something interesting about that show is my other friends that have done it said, hey, you know, you might want to be prepared because it's going to be chilly in there. I'm like, okay, sure. I get it then. Sure. So TV shows, they keep it chilly so they don't want to see anybody, you know, sweating. So we did sound check and I thought, well, this is a little, you know, the air conditioner's definitely on, but, you know, it's nothing horrible because on touring, you know, you play in hockey rinks and you still have ice under the floor and you just went over it. So it's chilly in there. And I thought, this is kind of like that. It's no problem. So I noticed the local crew guys all had hoodies on and sweatshirts. And I'm going, okay. And so we put our, after sound check, went great, put our guitars up, which they left out there behind the stage. And we went down to the green room and get dressed, come up. I say, okay, you know, you guys are on in X minutes. And I walk out into the studio and I'm going, holy crap, this is freezing out here.
Really?
I said it was 48 degrees or 49 degrees, something like that. I picked up my guitar.
49 in the studio?
In the studio. I mean, it was freezing. I'm sure there's an exact number somewhere, but I picked up the Strat I was playing. I was playing a Tom Anderson Strat on Reba's new single. I think the radio was the song, and I had a solo on it, and I thought, man, I'm practicing, you know, bending the strings, and they're bending about half of their normal because they're so cold. And of course, if you touch the strings, your body heat warms the strings and they go flat, and then you don't, you know. So there are so many things to think about, and I spent mostly 3 minutes kind of going, wow, this is cool, we're doing, you know, David Letterman. And I am totally freaked out right now. But the show went great. You know, everything happened awesome. And we went out and had a great New York dinner after that. But
it's up, up in 7th Avenue in the studio right up there. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Where'd y'all go to dinner? If you remember.
I don't remember.
It was so many places there.
Yeah.
How was, I don't know, Jay Leno or any of the other shows stand out?
Jay Leno was awesome. I got to do that. I think I got to do it when Johnny Carson was – it was still a Johnny Carson show, but Jay Leno was subbing for him because Jay came in and started subbing. And that was with Patti Loveless back in the late 80s, I guess. And I almost knocked myself out on that show. We did two songs back-to-back. And I had to start both of them. Patty had a song called Timber, which had a bunch of string bending stuff in it. And I think I had to use my telly with the G bender on that. And then I switched to the Strat for something and I had to start that song. And my telly got, you know, you have all the wires on. You have your cord that goes to your guitar, plus your ear pack wires. And sometimes those shows, at least at that time, they weren't wireless packs. So you had a big cord going up to your belt and, you know, all tangled up. And I tried to pull my telly off and it got stuck and I yanked it and hit myself right in the head.
Holy smokes.
And my tech hands me the other guitar and I hear 3, 4 and I start playing and I'm going, wow, do I have blood like leaking down my head right now? No, I didn't, but it sure felt like it.
Yeah.
The shows are a lot of fun to play. You know, but you really need to, again, being prepared takes one element out of that, you know, one of the nervous elements out of it. It's lots of times when I'm doing those shows and I'm playing a solo or something, the thing that comes to my head is, you know what? I played this 100 times. Today shouldn't be any different. And that's it's just one of the ways I get around being, you know, completely nervous about stuff.
Let me ask you a question. Do you ever, or when do you get to, or do you get to appreciate, not appreciate, you're the kind of guy, you got a great work ethic, and I'm assuming, and I'm like that, and so I don't ever really, like, if I do something or accomplish something, I never really, you know, to quote, pause. It's like on to the next thing. And I'm hearing you say, you know, like, you want to enjoy it, you're up there, but there's so many things going on, so many moving parts. You have to have a tremendous amount of discipline. You know, you got to nail your part down. You have some jitters, you got to deal with that. Do you ever get to, like, go back, or is there a time, like, maybe on the flight home, where you get to say, well, holy crap, man, I just played Jay Leno, or I, you know, this really, you know, not in an egotistical way, but in a, you know, wow, it's really, I feel good about that. It's a nice thing to do.
Oh, yeah. I think every one of those shows I left going, wow, what a great experience.
Okay.
Coming from where I grew up in East Tennessee, I think, man, I'm so glad to have been able to be presented that experience, to be able to do that. And, you know, you're right. You certainly focus, you know, focuses at an all-time high on that stuff. And I always come away going, wow, what a great experience. I'm glad I get to check that one off my box.
Yeah.
So
when do you usually do that, on the trip back, or when you get home and you're sitting and talking, you know, decompressing with your wife, or when do you typically go through that?
Well, there's usually a little bit of a process when we finish and I hand my guitar to my tech and I walk off stage, I go, whew, I'm glad that's over.
Right.
And then the second thing is it could be that night, you know, it's just a wandering thought or whatever. Get back to the hotel room and go, wow, you know, that was a really cool experience to do that. And I'm always intrigued by the setups and all the studios, the way everything works. And, it's just, it's a tremendous, the wheels that work are just unbelievable. You know?
Yeah. And to do that on a daily basis, that's really,
we got to do a lot of those TV shows. We did Jay Leno several times with Reba and, you know, all the New York stuff. We used to go to New York when she would release a new record. We would go up and spend 4 or 5 days, sometimes a week, just doing shows. And then we get to go out and eat.
Yeah, some good food up there, man.
Great food and great fun.
Yeah. Do you prefer playing on the road or in the studio? Or maybe a better question is, what are the pluses and minuses for you playing in a studio versus going on tour?
Well, I think when you're in the studio, your creative side is definitely on. And when you're on the road, you get to see the immediate response of things that happen. And there's even though, you know, we've talked about being prepared and stuff, you're still flying by the seat of your pants. There are many times when I've started to play something like a solo, for instance, maybe live, and something will happen. And all of a sudden I can't remember what I'm supposed to be doing next, but I know what key I'm in. I know what the song is. And so I finish it a different way. And there's a part of that that goes, wow, yeah, that's definitely, fun and interesting.
Yeah.
And when you come back, I think coming back to the studio, for me, it brings some of that energy back. I love being able to be on both sides of that. They both feed into each other for me. So
what are you working on now that you're excited about?
Well, I just worked last week at a studio, Blackbird, here in town, and worked on a wonderful young lady from Switzerland, and we did a record with her, and that was a blast. It was sort of a combination of modern yet bringing in the organic, like old tremolo Gretsches with reverbs and stuff. That was a lot of fun. And, you know, just, I think for guys like myself, you just look ahead at the next thing. So every project is unique and different, and you want to do a great job on it. So I just kind of look at the next thing and go, you know, how am I going to fit into this? And I don't know if that exactly answers your question, but.
No, I understand. I'm the same. I think that goes back to work ethic thing. I think when you have the strong work ethic, that's just it. It's just boom, and then, okay, what's next?
Right.
You know, it's like, do the job as well as you can, you know, 110%. Don't let anything with your name on it be sloppy. And
right.
Okay, what's next? I totally get that, man. You said a couple of times you're from East Tennessee, and I know we talked earlier. Where are you from, and where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Townsend, Tennessee, in the Smokies. Great place to grow up, right in the mountains, right at the edge of the national park. So, as we might have been talking earlier, I spent a lot of time in the mountains on the trails as a kid, and just learning about outdoor life and enjoying myself up there with my family and my friends. And my dad took me hiking at an early age and up on the Appalachian Trail. And that was, great memories of that stuff. And stuff I've passed on to my kids as well. So it's a blast to be out to do that.
Do you have any brothers or sisters you grew up with?
I have a younger brother. Yeah.
Is he into music?
Not so much. Anything musical, I think, in my family came from my grandmother that lived in Townsend, my dad's mom, and she played piano at the church. So early on, my mom made me take piano lessons for a couple years until I finally came home one day and went, this is awesome, but I really want to play the guitar.
How old were you, Aaron?
Probably 9 at the time.
And how did she react?
She's like, well, okay, you know, if it's something you really want to do. And I said, yeah. So they bought me a guitar, you know, as you would probably do for a kid. Let's buy him something, see what happens. Of course, it was a really hard guitar to play.
I was going to say, the strings 2 inches up off the
neck. So high. I was like, I don't think it's supposed to hurt like this. But a friend came over that we knew that there wasn't a ton of music. I mean, I'm from a little town in the wintertime. It was maybe 600-700 people. In the summertime, it was probably 5,000 because it was right up against the park. Mm. All the tourists would come in the summer. And there were bluegrass bands around, country bands. But in the next biggest town was Maribel, which was probably 30 minutes away. And
wow, that's far.
A little more eclectic stuff going on down there that I got to go see, you know, as I got to drive and stuff. But one of the country band singers came out. His name is Ronnie Sullivan, or is. And he came out and started showing me chords and stuff. Somebody reminded me the other day about my fourth grade show and tell. I brought a guitar in and said, well, you know, with guitar, you have the three major chords, G, C, and I can remember my fourth grade teacher just sitting in the back shaking her head. She's like, there might be a few more. And I went, not on guitar, there's not.
That's a great story, man. Well, some people still don't know that there's more than what kind of work did your dad do, or your mom? Was mom a stay-home mom?
Mom was a stay-home mom for a while. Then she worked at the post office and retired from the post office in my hometown. And my dad worked for the FBI.
Really?
He has some great stuff go on. He worked in the office. Well, they met in Washington, D.C. at the FBI office. And then dad transferred to Knoxville because he grew up in Townsend as well. And he wanted to have his family back at home. And he worked up there, and we would go visit him sometimes on Sunday evenings because not much going on. But
he was not working. And I don't imagine Townsend's a big, you know, FBI hot spot. No. So he was working in Knoxville, and he would commute.
commute come, back.
Come back and forth. Yeah, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Wow, that's very interesting, man.
Yeah, yeah.
You never had the bug to go into law enforcement?
Well, I did. But, you know, one night we were there visiting, and I was probably maybe six, and we were, I remember getting a drink of water at the water fountain. And all of a sudden this guy comes in, and they had caught one of the 10 most wanted, and they had, and he was one of them. And he comes walking by me in shackles on his legs and his arms and everything, all chained together with two agents with, you know, and I remember literally trying to get behind the water heater because it really scared me.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I want to be doing this.
No, I could understand that making a very indelible impression on somebody. Wow. What do you've got such a great work ethic. Where do you think you learned that? Or was there any part of your upbringing that contributed to that, or how you approach your business or how you approach your life?
Well, I think my family has that. And my grandmother used to tell me over and over again, my dad's mom that lived in Townsend would tell me, you know, if you're going to do something, you might as well do it right. However many times it takes you, because it needs to be done right. And she could have been talking about washing a car or anything, but that's something I always just remember. Her voice keeps coming into the back of my head, and, you know, why do anything halfway? So
that's great.
I try, but I don't always do it, but we try.
Well, I think you're probably doing it most of the time. So you start playing the guitar as a kid. How did this evolve, again, living in Townsend? Like, where did you, you know... This obviously you must have gone beyond that. How did that come about?
I found my uncle's guitar, which was this horrible, really bad guitar again.
And another one.
it was the first one, actually. That's okay. The one. And then my mom, they bought me essentially the same guitar, only a different color. And then when I think I was 10 or 11 for Christmas, I got a K Electric that was like a 335-y type thing, you know, and a Fender Vibro Champ amp.
Oh, very cool.
Which was very cool. And I started being able to hear some of the sounds that I'd heard on records and some of the stuff. And then as I was in high school, I moved up. I had that for many years, and in high school moved up to finally got a Strat and a Pro Reverb, so something a little bit bigger. And
yeah,
you know, the first band I was in was in the Eagles, you know, Hotel California, that bit, because I tell people that because when I'm sitting at home in my bedroom and playing on that record, I would play along with it. So that's all the time I knew how to get there, learn things, you know. So I would sit and learn that, and I would learn, you know, Marshall Tucker stuff and Atlanta rhythm section and, you know, whatever was at that time. I'd go buy the record and just sit there and try to hear things, and no telling how screwed up I got those parts and things, because I just picked out what I liked, and that's the part I would learn. So
I remember that song, Marshall Tucker, Can't You See? That was a beautiful solo. Was that Toy Caldwell? Was that his name?
Caldwell.
Yeah, what a beautiful... That was just gorgeous, man. What a great song that was. A great solo in there.
I love that. Love that band. I met him and got to hang out with him a little bit. And we had, you know, it was a really awesome moment. But
so did you ever play in high school, or...?
Just in a couple situations where we would get together and try to learn a song. And, you know, we were never very good. I don't think I learned anything about being good until I got to college.
Okay, so you went to, where'd you go to college?
East Tennessee State University.
Did you major in music there?
No, I actually majored in...
engineering, you told me, right?
Sorry. Engineering technology, yeah.
And were you playing guitar the whole time, like on the side, or...
I picked it up more when I got there, and then I started playing in a band, which was really exciting to me. Our first gig was at the Elizabethton Elks Club.
It's funny. It's cool that you remember that, man.
Yeah. Well, we were on the, you know, the animal circuit or whatever. We'd play the Elks Clubs, the Moose Clubs, the, you know, VF up there. I was in the two of us from college, and two of the other guys were local guys that were, you know, new. They were their gigs. We just happened to be in the band. So,
right.
I remember thinking, wow, we're making like $30 a night. I mean, this is crazy money for, you know, and all we're doing is playing guitar. And,
right.
But I don't know. There's just something inside me that just said, man, this is really awesome. I mean, I love creating and I love hearing the guitar as much as anything and trying to be better at it and just trying to be better and trying to be better and trying to be better. And, you know, sometimes you were better, sometimes you weren't.
Sure. So you graduate, you get your degree in engineering, and then you say, hey, I'm going to go to Nashville and play guitar? What?
said I'm
That's
going
a normal to... engineer career path.
Yeah, right. Well, I was straddling between going to architecture school and going to be an engineer, and guitar playing was in there, but I really wasn't sure if that was something that was going to be a reality for me or not. So I moved to Nashville and tried to get some engineering jobs. And of course, right out of college, well, we need somebody with experience. Well, I'm not the guy then because I don't have any experience. But so I did work for an architect for a while and continued playing. And then I got in another band here in Nashville, and we said, all right, we're going to go on the road. Do you want to go? And I went, absolutely. So we went on the road and we played horrible, horrible dive bar clubs, and we played great clubs. And it was a band from Texas that moved here to Core, and they added a couple guys from Nashville. And so I got my first experience touring with them, and which lasted a couple years. We would take off, be gone for 3 weeks, come home for a week, whatever, you know. But that was the real training ground for me, playing 4 or 5 hours a night, you know, learning songs, trying to learn them as best that I could, but then also trying to find my own style with that stuff. And one of the first bands and clubs I went into Nashville was this place on Murfreesboro Road. I can't remember the name of the club now, but the first guitar player I saw in Nashville was Brent Mason.
Oh, wow.
I walked in.
That's not good.
I thought I was okay. I didn't really think I was, you know, going to be anything nobody had ever heard before, but I thought it was okay. And I walked in and went, holy crap.
I need to reevaluate.
I'm at the bar here. The best thing that happened was that.
Yeah.
Because I thought, man, is everybody like this? Is this the bar? I need to get to work. So it became neon college for me. I would go there. Brent played 5-6 nights a week, and I would go 3 or 4 nights a week and just, you know, from 9 till 11 or something. And that was I'd go sit and watch and try to capture little things on a little mini cassette recorder and go home and go, well, I really don't understand what this is, but if I can learn some part of a lick he's playing or if it makes me think of something else, then that's great. And that was the best thing that ever happened to me. And Brent and I are friends. We've been friends for, you know, 30 something years now. And, he's a great guy and a great friend. And as you know, an amazing player.
I give you a lot of credit because I think that took a lot of, it shows the kind of person you are, like, to have the humility to say, okay, you know, there's a lot of ways you could have gone with that. You could have left there and got discouraged, number one. You could have said, you could have got indignant and said, okay, I'm going to do, but you didn't. You were nice and humble. You said, let me go there and learn. I think that takes a lot of, well, I mean, as a young person, especially, I think that, you know, I give you credit for doing that because that's not, you know, either one of those other ways, especially for a young kid, would have probably been just as acceptable, you know, understandable how somebody reacts. Right. I really give you a lot of credit, and it's probably changed your life doing that.
It changed my life, and there were many nights I walked out and went, I should just quit. I'll never, ever reach anything like this level. But then you sleep on it, and you get up, and you're like, all right, back in the trench, and get going again. So,
Well, I'm also assuming that you then started seeing other guitar players and realized, okay, I'm in the ball game, not his ball game today, but I'm in the this. He's not the standard,
right?
The
right.
You know, the frame of reference of the average guitar player is not Brent Mason.
Yeah,
which probably helped you out a lot.
It did help me out a lot, but I still wanted, I thought, well, Brent's got his thing. I need to develop whatever my thing is going to be and try to be equally as good at what I do as he is at what he does.
Yeah.
And I never think I've achieved that. I mean, I'll never wake up and go, okay, I've done it, because it's the moving target always. But, you know, I thank Brent for being so kind to me in those days. And you know, later on we would do lots of sessions together, and it was really cool.
So it started a long, lifelong friendship, that, you know, organic friendship. That's great, man. That's really good. So let's talk about that. You mentioned that you never there, and I get it. I totally get it. I have this expression, smart people realize how little they know, and stupid people think they know everything, right? So you started playing sessions in 92. And I know you're a very humble guy, so this is going to be a tough question. You've been a first call A-list person for a long time in a town where there's absolutely no shortage of good players. So my question is, as best as you think, why do you think you've gotten the call for so long?
Well... I think I try to show up. I always try to show up and bring something to the record, bring something unique. And I always show up wanting to do the best that I can do and do it. I always want to do a great job. So I think showing up and not being, you know, I'm sure we've all had the times when we've had an ego thing, but I always try my best to just keep that as out of it and just show up and I'm here to do what I'm supposed to be doing. And I'm here to have fun doing it, because it shows in the way in our music when we have fun. And, I don't know. I think just want to show up and do my best every day and be the best I can be and be friends with the guys that are there. And if you're ever here, you should come to a session with us, because it's half kindergarten, you know, half high level, national recording session, because there's so much, so many things that are so awesome about it. You're working with friends that you've known for a long time that are great players, and you have a great band, and we might start a song and the producer go, let's, you know, that's great, but can we go a little more this way, and everybody, and just to see the shift and all the guys and go, boom, okay, count it off. You know, here we are. Everybody wants that same thing. That's cool.
I hope you're serious about that, because I will take you up on that offer, because I'd love to come to a session and just sit there and watch, and I'd be like a little kid.
Oh, well, you should come when Jerry and I are playing together. We played.
I'd love to. Holy smokes. It sounds like what you're saying, too, is that you want to be an asset to the music beyond your guitar. You're looking to make a contribution to make that music better beyond, okay, let me play the guitar parts you want, or that makes sense.
Well, that's that, and that's a moving target, as you probably, from other guys that you've talked to. You show up, and some days you're the guy that listens to a work tape, which might be a guy singing an acoustic guitar. I mean, singing and playing an acoustic guitar. Then you might show up, and it be a completely dialed in demo of something that sounds like it could be the record, but for whatever reason, it's in a different key or a bat, you know, so far away they can't change it. But change it, you know, in Pro Tools or something. But so we'll recut it. Some days you're listening to be the creator, and some days you're listening to be the recreator. So it's different things for different producers. Sometimes the guy will come out and go, listen, give me eighth notes in the verses, and then on the choruses, I want just big, you know, diamonds from you, which is what we call whole notes. And then maybe lay out on the bridge, and he might come out and say exactly what he wants. And other times, well, here's our demo. Let's just go see what we can get into.
So it sounds like the quality of the producer, as you're saying it, I'm starting to understand the quality of an experienced or good producer really has a tremendous impact on the end result, whatever we wind up hearing.
Absolutely, totally. And also within that, I think all the producers that I've ever worked for, they all have different strengths of different things. And they all have a basic understanding, and you know, they're all basically great track listening guys. Some come in with great songs, and that's their strength, is they find great songs that fit their artist perfectly. And then while we're tracking, the band does a little more of the creation stuff, and the producer goes, "Yeah, I really like that," or, you know, "Can we not do this," or whatever. And then they're sometimes, when other elements are involved and the songs come in, whoever picked them or whatever, that producer is like, "Well, I've got these songs and got this band, and now we're going to go do this, and let's really dial in a modern thing or old school cross with modern. You know, let's bring in, let's the drummer is going to do a couple loops, and the keyboard player is going to do a part that goes, you know." So you think, well, what's my job in here? And when doing records, you know, sometimes you go in and you play it, kind of, you know, you kind of flow through it, and then they cut one. Sometimes that's the one, but more often I think than not is you play through it once, play through it again, and your head's sort of wrapping around a part. And usually by the end of the second take, I've got an idea on what my job is. And I can either go back and fix, you know, they'll punch me in to get those parts that I feel like I could make a little more solid. Or sometimes it's just easier for me. I get in the headspace and I go, let me run one from the top now that I know what I'm doing. But everybody's different. Sometimes, you know, the initial thought is the one that's captured, and that's the most brilliant piece. So there's lots of different ways of working.
You ever have situations where, like, you think you actually don't even like what you played, and the producer's like, "Yeah, man, that's it."
Oh, absolutely.
Really?
And you know, I think in my mind, especially on solos and stuff, they'll go, "Man, that's exactly what I'm looking for." And I go, "Wait, we need to listen to this one because I really like the way this felt to me." And then at some point I realize, well, my mind is hearing the way I'm thinking about it.
Yeah.
He's hearing it the way it's in the big picture. So, you know, you have to learn to let go of a little bit of that perfectionism.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It's not, I say perfectionism because it's only perfectionism in my mind.
I totally get it. Yeah, yeah. And it's almost like you can't understand, well, how can you not want to listen? And I get it. And he's probably, if you step out in his shoes, he's thinking, "What's wrong with this guy? That sounds amazing."
Right.
Yeah,
right.
It's interesting. Have you ever worked with either two guys that are producers that are amazing, Tom Dowd or Bill Simzik?
I've been around Tom. I don't think I've been around Bill.
What's it like working with Tom?
Well, I say I've been around him. I can't really recall doing anything where he's been the primary producer on a session. So.
Okay.
You know, he's been in the room, or I've met him, I can't remember anything.
Sure. No, it's all good. Jeff, everybody pays tuition in their career. And I was wondering if you'd be kind enough to share one or two mistakes that you might've made along your journey. And what did you learn from them? Hindsight being 2020.
Well, that's a tough one. I think your decision making process is really tough here, because in the session world, there are times you're booked on something and then somebody else calls you for that same time, and you kind of have this, you know, what do I do? But I don't know that I mean, I have a lot of regrets, but at the time I'm basing the decisions on the left hand, right hand. I don't know, you know, I think this doesn't clarify your question, but in my mind, my decisions are never made on about financial stuff in my music job. It's do I want to do it? Is it cool musically? Is it something that I can gain something from, you know, from the music or from the people that I'm working with? Those are my decision-making points normally.
What do you do if you're booked and then you get another offer, a better offer? I don't mean financially, but you get an offer of like an artist whose music you like more, an artist you've wanted to work with, other musicians you've wanted to work with. If you could say, I don't know if you can or not, because maybe you're like, oh, I always blow that off. Well, like, it's a tough spot to be in.
You just make the call. You just make the call to the guy producing the one you're on and go, hey, I have a situation, you know, and I just want to talk to you about it. And I got a call from, well, man, I'll give you an example. I was booked on a project playing electric for, I don't remember the artist, but a producer friend of mine. And I got a call to play acoustic on a Brooks and Dunn record. And which the guy producing the Brooks and Dunn record, Don Cook, we used to do tons of demos together, just he and I. He would program a little drum loop and he would say, I got this song. So I would go in and they would call, you know, hey, have you got anything open this week? I've got Wednesday afternoon. We'll come in Wednesday afternoon. We'll do it then. And I would lay down a couple acoustic tracks and then I would do a couple electrics. And sometimes he was a bass player. Sometimes he would play bass. Sometimes I would. And so I think we spent a lot of time together doing that. And so maybe his regular acoustic player couldn't make it. He thought, well, I'll just call Jeff. And I remember thinking, wow, what a great experience. I would love to do that. And so I called my friend Steve, who was producing. Luckily, they were both big records at the time. And I said, hey, do you think if I missed this one session, could I come back and overdub on it? Because I'd really like to work with Brooks and Dunn. It's, you know, really, I've known both those guys a long time. And he goes, I'd say yes, but I think what we're working on is really important. And I think we would miss your input there and I was like, well, I get it. So I just had to call Don Cook back and say, I can't do it.
Because you had made the commitment to.
I made the commitment. And the, you know, sometimes the producers will, they'll go, oh, sure, go ahead and do that. And, you know, and I'll catch you on the next one. And, but, you know, then you have the chance you might lose your spot there.
Sure.
But I don't know. It's all. As long as we're working, I'm happy.
Yeah, I guess you have to just at a certain point in time say, well, it wasn't meant to be.
Right.
To some extent, to rationalize the gap of, you know, what you want and what you, you know, what's reality, you know, to close right. That, we need a rationalization.
And at that time, all the records were double scale. So there was, you know, some. That's the big record years when you're selling records and CDs with 10 songs on them. So lots of songs were being manufactured per se, you know. So there were a lot of songwriters in town that had that had writing deals. There were a lot of record companies. So we were all staying really, really busy. And if you weren't doing a record, you might get booked on some demos. And then a producer might call and go, hey, can you come over? I get this has to go to mix. Can anyway you can come over tomorrow afternoon and do this? And I'd look at my book and go, whoa, got a demo for so and so, and you know, I'm going to have to call them and bail. Normally, you would call the band leader, whoever booked you for the demo, and go, hey, I've got a record date. You know, can I call somebody to fill in for me? Or in that, I've been band leader on hundreds and hundreds of demo sessions, and it's not unusual to get a call the day before, or I've even got a call the night before, and my, you know, the keyboard player, hey man, I got a call to go do something for Rascal Flatts or whatever, can you cover me? It's like, yeah, sure. I mean,
so you support, everybody's understanding it, you're chasing down that kind of opportunities. Yeah, you want to work with people. How does this work? Okay, so you get calls, like do studios decide who brings you in, or do producers, or both? And is it in your best interest to limit the number of studios or maximize? How does that work, like to generate business, I guess?
Well, for my career, it's been more relationship based. Like if the producer books the studio and is booking Reba for a record, or Faith Hill, or you know, Lee Bryce, whatever, the producer will call and say, hey, here are the X amount of days, whatever it is, and this is where we'll be, you know, trying to line up schedules, you know, can we do it this week, whatever, which may be in 2 or 3 weeks away, you know. And again, you might have to clear your schedule a little bit, excuse me, and then sometimes the studio will call because maybe somebody's coming in from out of town. They don't know how to do a project. So they call Oceanway here in Nashville and they talk to the person there and they say, hey, I'd like to come in and book a studio. Can you help me? I've got 5 songs I want to do. And how do I do it? Hmm. How do I get somebody to produce this? And how do I get a band together? And he'll go, well, you know, I can help you with that. And sometimes those guys would call me or, you know, some one of their guys they know, and they say, hey, we need a band for these days or this day or whatever, and this is what we're doing. Let's put a band together. And so I think both things are just, I think in our town, relationships are really, really important to have all over. And
Yeah, because you never know where that phone call is coming from.
You never know, and you never know when somebody's going to call me and say, hey, I want to do a project, and it's a 2-day thing, where can I go? And you go, well, hey, you know, let's go to Oceanway. You know, I like it there because I like the guy, and that's a great facility. Or let's go to Starstruck, or let's go wherever. You know, lots of times it'll depend on, here's my budget for
sure,
what I'm trying to do. And sometimes you help people kind of develop their budget realistically, and that can be sometimes that's very eye-opening for people that are coming into town because they don't know, and you know, I always try to be straight up and here's what it is, and you know,
so it works both ways. It's reciprocal. It's the studios calling you, producers calling you, you at this point in time in your career, you calling, you giving them referrals, you both, you know, it's both ways. Okay. Interesting. The flip side of that question is, and I don't think you asked, I don't really think you answered, decision-making. That you said that was tough as far as mistakes. Well, you said you had a lot of regrets, which I was surprised.
Well,
You're probably tough on yourself, so I want to hear these regrets. Well, I could just imagine that, you know, your regrets are probably not the normal regret. You know, when you're tough on yourself, man, you have, you know, the regrets you have, you know, you tell somebody else, like, man, I wish, you know. But yeah. I was curious.
I think for me, I mean, you know, there are a lot of personal things and that we wish we could change, I guess. Regrets is a heavy word. Mm. Probably. And you always regret something after it's gone wrong, right?
Oh, yeah. So it's not a regret until it gets screwed up.
It's not
up.
A regret until you're hanging your head with your tail between your legs. And, yeah. And oh, boy, what?
Until the consequences come.
Yeah. And a lot of that is, it's just stupid stuff. Well, now I'm looking back at stupid stuff, but... have you ever played on a song and it comes time to play the solo or something and your mind just goes blank and I don't even know what key I'm in, what song this is, and I don't know what's caused me to do this. And I mean, those aren't huge regrets, but you look back and go, boy, I should have sat backstage and gone over this a little more, and because I'm representing this artist, and I need to be on my game. So I don't know. Regrets is a strong word.
It's yeah, just, I think that's just normal. I think, you know, that's if you're doing something 10,000 times, I mean, statistically, it is really unlikely that that would not happen.
Right.
A handful. That's just numbers to me. I mean, to me, as an outsider looking in, right. I'm like, no matter what you're doing.
I think I approach it as I'm getting paid to do this right.
I get it. I totally get it because I'd be the same. But I think that's I think that's almost to be expected. It just happened to be on that night with that person. And, you know, you're always going to, you know, it's not likely that would happen. You'd ever say, well, if it had to happen on somebody, I'm glad it happened to that guy, it, you know, because you probably wouldn't be in that situation in the first place, you know. But, yeah, I think that's a numbers thing.
I think. And, you know, my wife is a musician, too. We're both self-employed musicians, and she's a fiddle player. And one day she said, you know, if you're doing that and your mind goes blank, you're still going to play something that works because it's just the way it is, you know. And once I kind of went, oh, whew, you know, after thinking that through a little bit, it's unless it's the hardest song I've ever played, which is one of Reba's songs called "Does He Love You," which is in three keys. It's kind of the same thing in three keys, but it just makes my head hurt.
I hear that.
But it's a good song, and the solo, if you ever lose footing on the solo, you're done with that one. It's such a melodic Dan Huff solo and just beautiful piece of music. And
that's what I was thinking when you said it was one of the hardest. I said, I'll bet Dan Huff did that. In the back of my head, I was thinking that. So the flip side of that question, so you're absolved, man. Those are not regrets. Move on. You can move on now. I think it's safe, Jeff. So how about the other side where is there anything, one or two things you might have done which at the time were out of your comfort zone but turned out to be really good decisions that you know, something great came out of them?
I think, yes, I'd say yes, and trying to remember exactly what that would be. I always try to push myself into uncomfortable places. And generally speaking, for me, it's the more musically, it would be a little more jazzy or oriented stuff. Because I didn't really get very deep into that. I mean, I had a great appreciation for Larry Carlton and Robin Ford and those guys, and those were blues based jazz type things. But, early on, when I started playing sessions, one of the guys at a publishing company that I met that used to hire me for sessions, he said, you know, here's some advice. He said, if I were you, I would go do whatever you need to do to get a collection of varied music from one extreme to the other, from the jazziest of jazz to the jazzy Christmas songs to hard country to modern country to pop to rock, you know, and even learn something about metal and whatever. And I did that. And I found myself on sessions a lot where we would do a couple songs and they said, hey, I wrote this swing song. I really want to try to get this to George Strait. And if I hadn't have bought a box set of whoever swing guy at the time, you know, Bob Wills or whatever, and learn all those things and some of the chording things that would go on, I would have been totally freaked out more than I was at the time because I thought I have a handle on this, but I'm not the guy for that. I just know how to do it.
Right.
And a lot of times in the studio, I found that if I can get the sound, if I can dial in the sound, then I can play a part that sounds like the part. So
that advice that guy, at least you are really good about being open and taking advice and listening. That's really, I mean, you're not, I mean, that goes back to the thing with Brent where you know, you said, hey, let me check this. You know, you opened, you listened, and you got better. Same thing with this guy. You didn't say, well, you know, I don't need that. You say, okay, it's good. Let me go out and get this. And you listen, and you got it turned into a smart thing for you.
Well, every time without fail that I thought, you know what? I think I'm reaching a really good spot where I'm really starting to play good. I'll go out and either fail epically or see somebody just do stuff that is like, wow, you know? So I've just learned to not always look at everything as input.
Hmm. You know, try to
spread out and learn and use what I can. And I mean, there are some great guitar players in town right now. And you know, I do sessions with all those guys and I'm always kind of watching and going, wow, what was that? And what pedal makes that sound? And what, you know,
sure,
whatever. But
do you know Mike Durham?
Oh, I know. Yeah. I know Mike really well.
Yeah. You know what? He and I had a really long, very good conversation, I think yesterday or the day before. And he said the same thing. He said when he was younger, because he's got a pretty good jazz background.
He does, yeah.
And he said he took lessons from that, I forgot the guy's name, up in New York. He was a pretty well-known guy. I can't think of his name. But he said someone gave him the same exact advice when he was younger. And he said, look, learn everything and you'll always work. But that, you know, which is the same thing that this guy told you. So, and then he did the same thing. He went out and, you know, and he's a pretty busy cat.
Yeah.
So
Mike's a great guy. Great player.
Really, really nice guy. Really good guy. And then he pulled out his guitar. I hate when you guys pull out I love it, but when you pull out your guitars after we're finished talking, sometimes I'm like, man, I'm never playing guitar again. I can't. I feel like if you could go back and give advice to your younger self, what advice would you have given?
I would say try to focus on exactly what we've been talking about. Maybe just a little bit more about trying to get a little deeper into some of this stuff that you're not comfortable with. You know, I think I've got a little bit of a situation where if I can get distracted easily by things that happen. And I think just, you know, committing a little more to learning. I wish I would have learned a little more about reading. I learned to read a little bit, and here in Nashville, it doesn't come up very often. We read rhythms all the time, every day, and I'm really good at that. But to read the actual notes and stuff, I can get through it, but I'm really slow. Yeah. And there have been a couple times where somebody set something down and gone, hey, here's the part. And there have been a couple times when I've just said, you know what? I'm just not the guy for this. And there have been a couple times, most of those times, I can walk over to the keyboard player and say, hey, I can almost understand this. I can't quite make out what's happening here. And they'll go, da-da-da-da. And you go, oh, okay, boom.
Okay.
I had another epic fail on a jingle one time when a guy set a piece of music in front of me, and I was just like, he said, you know, here's what you want if you want to go look over it. And I went and looked over, and I was like, holy cow.
It's like a foreign language.
had it been a little straighter situation, I would have been fine. But it was way more complicated. And this is going to sound crazy because, you know, I'm sure anybody that listens to this would go back and think, well, this is simple. You should know this already. But we were doing a jingles for, I can't remember, some insurance company, and we did When I'm 64 by the Beatles. Mm-hmm. And they handed me the guitar piece, and they said, it's just a little piece that comes in the third verse. And I went, oh, okay. So I went and sat down, and it was to me, and I'm sure a lot of people have different opinions, and I respect all that, but to me it was like George Harrison had just learned about Chet Atkins, and he came out down, sat down, he went, just very randomy things. And I was trying to read it, and I was trying to write numbers under it so I could read the rhythms. And I just finally said, this is so random. It's not really a part. It's just thing. And if you go listen to the record, it's way back in the back, and you can just hear these little things. It's very cool. But I finally surrendered. I went and said to the, and I flew up to Chicago to do it with a couple of other guys. And I finally went to the guy producing and said, "I'm sorry. I don't know my way through this." He said, I had agonized for a couple hours over this because they were doing other overdubs and I was just hanging out. And he said, "Oh, that's no problem." He said, "Just sit down. We'll just do it a bar at a time. No problem."
Oh, wow.
Wow.
What a cool dude.
Absolutely. He just saw, you know, my face. I'm going to fail at this, and there's nothing I can do. I have no time to prepare for this. And,
yeah.
It was a great experience, and I took away learning from it. And there have been a couple other times. I'm not sure how this relates to your question, but there was one time we were recording a huge, big gospel thing for a church, and the chart was 4 or 5 pages long, and it wasn't. You know, most of the time here we use numbers.
Yeah.
And we can get our way through the songs with numbers, but this one was a huge, big thing. Changed all the keys so many times, and it was, you know, it was a letter chart, and that's fine. We can all do that, but it started getting into massive, heavyweight piano-y changes, and I think after my third time through, I was by myself. Everybody had gotten their partner in, and they're off in the lounge, and I was somewhere about halfway down the third page, and I had just totally massacred something, and I stopped. And he said, "Hey, you want to just pick it up a little bit earlier than that?" And I said, "Yeah, but I think you just might want to send this to, you know, this guy or this guy, because they're really good at this, and I'm just really not." And he's again, you know, I think I was honestly surrendering. I mean, and he said, no, he said, "We're fine. We'll just take it slow. We'll just back up and go until we get to the next spot." Because obviously in that type of song, it was such a piano heavy song that the guitar just needed to be heard every now and then. And it wasn't like really big guitar song. And we made our way through it. And I went into the control room and I said, "I really appreciate you doing that. That really, you know, I really want to do a good job." And I just felt like I was way out of my comfort zone, and said, no, we're good. We got what we needed, and we'll sort through it." So
that's great. Well, I mean, look, if you went to the guy honestly, and the other thing was, as you said, both of these situations, this was not a technical issue. Like if they bought another guitar player in, technically, so they, you know, say, "Hey, we know you could do this. We'll work it that we need to get it done at your pace. Slow it down, whatever we need to do to get you comfortable with it." Yeah, that made total sense. That's good. I'll tell you something real funny, though. Mike Durham, I said, "Anything you wish you would have done different?" Something like that. He goes, "I wish I would have studied reading music." So that's very interesting. I mean, exact same answer. He goes, "You know, I've gotten my way through everything, but I wish I was a little better." And he's another guy, real good work ethic. Right. You know, "I wish I would have gotten a little bit better in music, you know, reading charts."
That's funny because I always think of Mike as a good reader.
It's all frame of reference, how you look at yourself.
Yeah.
You know, because he might be, you know, 95 percentile.
Right.
But his frame of reference is, "Man, if I only knew the other 5% or 3 out of the 5%, then I'd be where I..." So it's just about pushing forward, like, you know, we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
That was interesting. Hey, everybody, this is Craig Garber. Thank you so much for listening to part one of this amazing interview with Jeff King. On part two, we'll talk about things like his gear, current guitars he's using, go-to guitars. I think we'll talk about the top 5 studio guitars, who are his biggest influences. And we'll also talk a little more about things that make him tick, things from his past that make him tick and have the biggest influence on him today. This is totally one of the best interviews I ever did. I really enjoyed Jeff, and I hope you're enjoying him too. And if you like part one, let me tell you, you're going to absolutely love part two. So thanks for listening. Give me some feedback. Let me know. And I'll look forward to talking to you on the next episode where you can hear the rest of this interview with the amazing Jeff King. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast. And you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more five-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.